Rum, rebels, and ratbags.
Hardcore history from the Transportation Nation with Dave Hunt and Dom Knight.
Welcome to the podcast awarded a $2 billion grant by Infrastructure Australia to talk about building things. When Australians build, we build big. The big marina at Goulburn, the big banana at Coffs Harbour, the big mosquito at Hexham Bowls Club. But if you want to talk about building big Aussie style, then you can't go past the big governor, Lachlan Macquarie. I'm Dom Knight, and I'm joined by the big historian who stands in imposing 6'3" in the old scale and weighs in at an incredible 120 kilos, David Hunt, the author of Gert, the Unauthorised History of Australia. David, hello.
And a big hello to you, Dom.
Now, Lachlan Macquarie may not have been picked as the infrastructure governor from his humble beginnings. Where did he start off in life?
He was born in 1762 in one of the least built-up parts of Britain. It's a tiny windswept island called Ulva. But he joined the army at age 14, and he goes to both America and Jamaica, but he doesn't get to fight anybody. And that was a great disappointment to him, because the reason that many Scots joined the British armed forces was for the opportunity to loot the cities of the defeated foe, to take the spoils of war. So he was profoundly disappointed that he saw no action and he saw no loot.
Okay, so the military career didn't seem to be working out for the young Lachlan Macquarie. What does he do then?
Well, he resorted to the other tried and true means of social and financial advancement. He sought to marry up. He's impressed by Jane Jarvis, who's the daughter of a wealthy Jamaican plantation owner. And Lachlan is determined to impress her with his discipline. And he defines this in his diary as getting dressed by 2:30 in the afternoon, drinking no more than 12 glasses of wine and one strong beer a night, and only consuming malt liquor during daylight hours.
Oh, he's practically a member of the temperance union.
He liked a wee dram.
No dry July for Lachlan Macquarie. All right, so how does this marriage with Jane Jarvis work out?
He loves Jane and Jane loves him. It's a passionate relationship. But Jane's family insists on a prenup, limiting Macquarie's access to her fortune. And he actually falls out with his in-laws when it's discovered that he's dipping into her inheritance. She dies in 1796 and Macquarie's absolutely devastated. But the silver lining for that particular cloud is the £6,000 inheritance that he gets out of it, which was a sizable fortune in the day.
Okay, so Lachlan Macquarie, not entirely averse to using other people's money for his ends, I gather.
That's something of a theme throughout his life. Another example, when he was the regimental paymaster in India, he actually would take the soldiers' wages and invest them for his own personal benefit before paying them. And he makes about 6% profit a month through his canny investments, but he's not bearing the risk. The soldiers whose pay he is investing are doing that for him. He is interested in marrying again, but the object of his affections is practical rather than rich, and practicality was another thing that Macquarie greatly admired. So before he leaves for India, he's asked Elizabeth Campbell to marry him. Now, she's his second cousin once removed and sister to his aunt by marriage.
Because almost part of Clan Macquarie.
Indeed. In these small Scottish islands, you had very little to do on a cold winter's night other than to chat up your cousin. So Elizabeth is a fiercely intelligent woman. She's interested in horticulture. She's interested in architecture. And she goes on to apply those skills when she later moves to New South Wales with him.
Now, they had a problem, of course, at this time with the New South Wales Corps,
yep,
who were more or less running the colony and running a lot of rum at the same time.
And so Britain had decided that it was going to recall the Corps and replace them with the Black Watch. And Macquarie, as their commander, is going to be 2IC of the colony. But the nominated governor, a guy called Nightingale, develops this mysterious arthritis of the wrist. And every time he's said, if it's time to go, he says, no, my wrist's too sore to be governor.
You've got to sign a lot of paperwork.
Yes. But after months and months of this, he pulls out and Macquarie gets the plum posting himself. And that was an unusual choice for Britain because he's 47 years old. making him the oldest lieutenant colonel in the army. He's got this extensive history of fraud. His skin's yellowed with malaria and a liver that had been kicked by Johnny Walker for decades.
He ends up, nevertheless, heading down to New South Wales to become the new governor. What was his first impression on sailing through the Heads?
As he actually enters the Sydney Heads, he's greeted by Bungaree, who you'll recall was the Aboriginal man who circumnavigated Australia with Flinders and Trim. And Bungaree, by this stage, is wearing mismatched sailor's clothes and a fake admiral's hat. And he now calls himself the King of Botany Bay, and he greets incoming vessels with this sort of wacky routine that earns him laughs, free food and the occasional coin. He's sort of an Antipodean sort of Uncle Tom figure. He treats himself as a bit of a joke because that's the way he finds that the establishment figures are most comfortable with him.
So Lachlan Macquarie becomes the fifth governor of New South Wales. Where did we leave William Bligh after the Rum Rebellion? Wasn't he being locked up?
We left Bligh under house arrest at Government House. And when Macquarie actually comes out, he has orders to restore Bligh as governor for a day.
That kind of a symbolic thing?
It's a symbolic thing to say this should never have happened, there should have never been this rebellion. You're back as governor and, your 24 hours are up on the boat back to England. But Bligh had been released from house arrest earlier on the condition that he leave for England. But when he's actually put on the boat back to England, for once in his life, he mutinies and he seizes the ship and he takes it to Van Diemen's Land, where he encourages all of the Vandemonians, the Tasmanians down there, to invade New South Wales on his behalf.
And avenge the honour of the ex-Governor Bligh. How did that go down, David?
Well, unsurprisingly, the Tasmanians were not particularly keen on mounting a military campaign to attack Sydney.
The much larger colony off the coast.
No, they thought this was a bad idea. And so Bligh is furious. He actually spends 6 months blockading Hobart, trying to impose a sort of one-man naval net around Hobart. And so once again, he's actually starving at sea. He's there in the ship, and the only way that he sort of manages to eat is by letting ships through his blockade in exchange for, a few biscuits and pickled cabbage.
Now, the Corps officers had, during the period of the rebellion, taken over much of the running of government, of course. What happened when Macquarie tried to come in and act as something of a new broom?
The Corps had not just run the government post the Rum Rebellion. They had their fingers in every aspect of colonial public life for 15 years. So they really do leave a vacuum. And Macquarie and the officers of the Black Watch just aren't familiar with the colony. So Macquarie, rather than appointing his own soldiers to these sorts of public official roles, does something amazing. He actually appoints ex-convicts to lots of senior positions, including magistrates. So these people who were once chained in the inside of a ship are now passing judgment on soldiers and settlers and others in the colony. It was a radical policy at the time. And he said, "My principle is that when once a man is free, his former state should no longer be remembered or allowed to act against him." So this was basically saying, you do the crime, you do the time, you should then be able to integrate into society.
Well, particularly in a penal colony, one might have thought. So, as you said before, they then became incorporated, some of these emancipated ex-convicts, into the judicial system. And what happened when, for instance, they started trying those who had not been convicts?
It would be fair to say that those who had not been convicts were often less than impressed. And so you have the emancipist faction, which is finding favour with the governor, and you have the opposing exclusive faction. And these were the British-born free settlers and officers and those who'd profited under the Corps. And they refused to associate with the emancipists and sought for them to be excluded from society. And these British-born people referred to themselves as sterling, after the pound of silver that served as the British monetary standard. And they dismissively referred to the native-born as currency, after the banknotes that lacked the intrinsic value of the sterling. And that's where you get the term currency lads from. And some of the native-born Australians then adopt that label with some pride. But it was originally meant as a term of denigration and abuse.
as we know, despite being an autocratic governor, popular support was important in the colony. How did this approach go down?
Macquarie realises he's got to get the broader population on side, and he's a really populist governor. Whilst an autocrat, he adopts the sort of bread and circuses approach adopted by the Roman emperors, and he cements goodwill in the colony by providing free sports events, very, very Australian. He establishes Hyde Park for the recreation and amusement of the inhabitants of the town, and he holds the first sanctioned horse races there 2 days later in a drunken 3-day racing festival. He gets women to race in sacks for a wheel of cheese. He organises boxing fights. He really cements this sort of popular rule through the early Australian love of sport.
Yes, and successive governments have gone on to do that. But he also appealed to members of the establishment as well, didn't he?
Yeah, look, he played both sides of the equation. Whilst being the fun governor, he also courted conservatives with this morals campaign. So he outlaws nude bathing. He introduces a range of Sabbath-breaking laws, including a prohibition on shooting a neighbour's dog on a Sunday. Apparently you could shoot your neighbour's dog the other 6 days of the week. He builds a wall around the domain to prevent lewd, disorderly men and women using it for the most indecent and improper purposes. And most importantly, he is determined to stop people living in sin. You've got men and women who have been in the colony for decades and have never got married. And so Macquarie discourages de facto arrangements by passing laws to prevent de factos from inheriting from their partners.
Okay, so one of the biggest problems, of course, for any governor at this point was how to deal with the liquor trade. It's been an issue since the very start of the colony. What was Macquarie's approach?
He comes out with orders from Lord Castlereagh, the colonial secretary, and Castlereagh has ordered him to prohibit the use of spirituous liquors. Macquarie realises that's just completely unrealistic, and instead he distributes lucrative liquor licences to his allies to sort of embed loyalty further, and he recommends that Britain approve the unlimited importation of alcohol with a really steep rise in import duties. So he wants to use alcohol as a way of funding some of his reforms in New South Wales.
So he uses the money raised from booze to fund a building program.
The famous Rum Hospital is perhaps the best known example of the way that he used alcohol
on Macquarie Street, of course.
On Macquarie Street, of course. That he pays Darcy Wentworth and two other entrepreneurs to build him this vast, stylish marble hospital with lots of ornamental pillars and ostentatious latticework. And to do this job for him, he gives them 80 oxen, 20 bullocks and 20 convict labourers. And most importantly, the exclusive right to import 60,000 gallons of rum into the colony over a period of 3 years. And Darcy Wentworth and his mates saw this as a licence to print or rather pour money.
Which it seems like. Is that how it turned out?
No, it wasn't a good deal for the entrepreneurs at all, because Macquarie was a master of fine print, and he said the deal didn't include shipments already approved, and unbeknownst to the investors, Britain had approved Macquarie's proposals re unlimited liquor, and 76,000 gallons was on its way to the colony, which was more than Wentworth and Co. had permission to bring in over 3 years. Macquarie also reserved the right to import what government may deem necessary for its own use and occasions. So Macquarie allows himself to be free from this deal with the developers and imports vast quantities of rum that he uses to pay convicts for their labour on other public works projects.
Very happy to deem himself a whole bunch of grog.
He deemed away like there was no tomorrow. And the developers had learnt an important lesson. You know, never play Monopoly with a Scot. They took on huge losses out of this deal.
That can probably be seen as a fairly major contribution to the public good. Mm. Did it, though, function well as a hospital?
Look, it was colloquially known as the Sydney Slaughterhouse. And
that's a no.
Yeah, if you think the public health system in Australia is bad today, you really need to look back at our past. But the architect, the mysterious architect of the Rum Hospital, had forgotten to include any toilets in the design. So you've got bedpans being thrown out of windows onto the street. That is when the windows were open, because they were not open regularly as patients kept on trying to escape out of them. You've got the kitchen used as a morgue, so the food is cooked in wards. Yuck. So in the actual wards, you've got these bedpans piling up, you've got the smell of cooking, syphilis is rife. You know, the venereal patients are locked in a storeroom, and the doors of male and female wards are locked from outside in a futile attempt to prevent the patients from having sex. It's pretty chaotic. And the nurses would actually throw warm meat at the ill rather than approach them to protect themselves from contagion. And those nurses would also sell hospital supplies, bandages and the like on the black market.
So it's a really common situation in Australia. You've got a great building, but things don't necessarily work well inside it.
That's right. And it seems somehow fitting that this building, you know, shining on the outside but rotten its core with its disease, noxious vapours, illicit intercourse, petty theft, hurled food and excrement, and its inmates shielded from public view, now serves as New South Wales's Parliament House.
I'll take that as a comment. All right. So. Corey's struck himself a pretty sweet deal here. He's in return for a few cows and convicts, he's got a whole bunch of spirit duties and a free hospital.
Yeah. Valued at £40,000 and £9,000 in spirit duties, and all he's done is invested a few cows and convicts in it. And this is Scottish financial management at its absolute best. But he's criticised by the new colonial secretary, Lord Liverpool, who sees that building a hospital for sick criminals is a waste of money, and that using spirits to fund the public works program, Liverpool said, was an embarrassment. And this ignores the reality that Macquarie had no power to raise taxes, so he needed to come up with these sorts of innovative solutions to build the things he wanted to make the colony a better place.
And, of course, in these days, rum is the currency in New South Wales, but Macquarie is the man who decides that, no, you wouldn't do too badly to have a currency that wasn't alcoholic and liquid.
What a radical concept. So come 1813... Macquarie imports 40,000 Spanish dollars, and he gives them to a convicted coin forger, William Henschel, to make New South Wales's first currency. And Henschel cuts a hole out of the middle of the coin, and the main coin, known as the Holy Dollar, Macquarie values at a dollar, and the bit that's cut out of the middle, known as the dump, is valued at a quarter dollar. So he's, in a single sort of blow, increased the colonial treasury by 25%.
So Macquarie also, not satisfied with clearing up the financial arrangements in the colony, he wants to clean up the settlement as well and continues his program of building.
Yeah, look, Macquarie is the infrastructure governor. He doesn't like the sort of ramshackle laneways, muddy laneways that make up Sydney. So he straightens Sydney's streets. He insists that the houses be fenced and numbered. And despite continued criticisms from back in Britain that he's wasting money building things for criminals, he builds, in a fairly short period of time, over 265 public works projects.
How does he pay for them? Because we've established that he couldn't tax.
So it's not just booze that he uses to fund them. He also introduces toll roads into the colony. And so toll revenue is used to fund infrastructure projects, much in the same way that it is now.
So there's another fellow that we know from our old paper money, the colonial architect, Francis Greenway.
Yeah, Greenway is this interesting character. He's an architect back in Britain. He's sent out as a convict for 14 years for forging financial documents. He's antisocial. He's arrogant. He can't talk to people properly. And he speaks his mind. And that's what impresses Macquarie. So Greenway is set loose building all sorts of public works. If you have a look through many parts of Sydney, you'll see Greenway's hand. But he was a strange sort of form over function architect. He converts a courthouse into a church. and a school into a courthouse. He constructs these Gothic forts at Bennelong and Dawes Point. They were useless militarily, but they look pretty cool in a sort of detached, brooding, Gothic kind of way. He erects a miniature Greek obelisk to serve as a reference point for the colony's milestones, and a not-so-miniature Greek temple to serve as a water pump for thirsty soldiers. And in the neoclassical lighthouse he builds at South Head, he wants to include a giant frieze as a tribute to the winds, and he includes a domed room for the governor's pleasure, but insufficient space for the troops who are meant to be stationed there. And my favourite work of his, which is no longer there, is the lighthouse he builds at Newcastle, which inexplicably took the form of a Chinese pagoda.
But yes, an eccentric fellow.
And Macquarie is also looking to modernise, you know, living in the colony, and actually renovates Government House out at Parramatta and installs Australia's first flush lavatory, which was a crowning achievement in the colony. So he's literally building a new society, and his building works are a concrete demonstration that he sees New South Wales as something more than just a jail. He wants to build a modern society that people will want to come and live in and go to the toilet in too.
Yes, and he's left the colony flush with funds as well. He also pushed the colony, David, beyond the settlement in Sydney.
Yeah, look, when Macquarie arrives, the colony was made up of land within a day's ride of Sydney and the convict hellholes at Newcastle, Norfolk Island and Van Diemen's Land. So We hadn't extended into the countryside much at all. But Macquarie's an expansionist. He's an active explorer. And like in his Indian Army days, he goes out exploring himself, and he explores with an entourage. He explores the Hunter Valley with over 50 companions, including a band of musicians he's taken with him. And he explores long and he explores hard. And so you've got all these musicians carrying their instruments, you know, dragging behind the exploration train. He sets out new towns and of course, he names each main street. Do you know what it would be, Dom?
I had a guess, Macquarie Street.
Yep, you'd be right. He names every main street after himself. No,
after the clan, David, excuse me.
After the clan.
What more fitting name could you have than the fine clan Macquarie?
Fine Macquarie. And occasionally, when he got bored of calling things Macquarie, he'd call them Lachlan. He names rivers, hills, falls, fields, plains, a pass, an island, a mountain, a tower, a fort and a port after himself. So he's an exploring kind of governor, and after Wentworth, Blaxland and Lawson cross the Blue Mountains, he orders that Australia's first inland town be built at the site of Bathurst. He appoints a guy called John Oxley as the Surveyor General because of his liberal education, which is obviously an arts degree, is invaluable in exploring the continent, and sends him to explore the inland. And so Oxley spends 1817 and 1818 lost in the Lachlan and Macquarie River marshlands, and he comes back and tells Macquarie, we don't need to do too much more inland exploring because the entire interior of the continent is a vast inland sea.
Incorrect.
So it would appear, yes.
But when we talk about going in and establishing inland towns and so on and so forth, that also means further incursions into Aboriginal lands, of course.
Yeah.
How does that go down with the local owners?
Macquarie really wanted good relations with the Aboriginal people. He even invites Aborigines to Lachlan Jr.'s birthday parties, although not the ones that white people were invited to. Lachlan loved this sort of birthday segregation because the Aborigines used to give him really good gifts, not the boring things like Bibles that he got and his normal ones.
You talk about Lachlan Jr.
Lachlan Jr. Mm. The Aborigines give him dead birds because Lachlan Jr. loves dead birds. And so these are badly stuffed, and Government House guests were always complaining about the smell of dead parrots.
It was dreaming of the fjord.
They were definitely not just pining for the fjords. They were well and truly dead. He was the first governor to really pursue assimilation policies. So he regards Bungaree as this prototype from which he might design a sort of new, improved Aborigine.
This is the fellow who met Macquarie's boat as he arrived.
The first Aboriginal man that Macquarie meets, Macquarie thinks he's great, and he gives him this lovely brass nameplate inscribed with the words Bungaree, chief of the Broken Bay tribe. And this is a tribe and position that Macquarie has completely made up. And he, as sort of an experiment, he exiles Bungaree and his family to work on a model farm to see if the Aboriginal people could be encouraged to adopt agricultural practices. But Bungaree couldn't see the need to spend all day tilling the earth when he could be on the harbour, so this experiment fails. He establishes this school to teach Aboriginal children how to become cheap farm labourers and domestic servants. And one of the rules is children are not permitted to leave or be taken away from the school until the boys turn 16 or the girls turn 14. It was sort of Australia's first stolen generation in many respects. And the idea was that the graduates of this fine educational establishment would renounce their traditional ways, they'd marry each other, and they'd set up on small acreages supervised by white managers in a small settlement he'd established just for them, away from the main township of Sydney in a place he called Blackstown, which is now the Sydney suburb of Blacktown.
So the Australian pattern of assimilation masquerading as benevolence was set by Lachlan Macquarie.
That's where it really starts, yeah.
How do relationships with the Aboriginal population go more broadly?
Things really go pear-shaped in 1816 after an Aboriginal boy is shot dead by soldiers whilst raiding a cornfield. The Aborigines, in payback, mutilate a soldier, and Macquarie orders his troops to, in Macquarie's words, inflict terrible and exemplary punishments on the hostile tribes. When soldiers chase members of the Gandagara tribe, at least 14 of them, mostly old men, women and children, are shot dead. Many more of the tribe throw themselves off the cliffs to avoid the soldiers and their dogs, and this is now known as the Appin Massacre. Macquarie really cracks down. He passes laws preventing Aboriginal people from gathering in more than groups of six people. He forbade Aboriginal people from bringing weapons into the Sydney area, and he introduced a passport regime that Aborigines who proved themselves peaceful could apply for a passport to show to people who wanted to shoot them. But unfortunately, a passport doesn't have the same range as a musket. So you've got a period of intense unrest and tension with the native population, and that goes on for several months before Macquarie starts retracting some of those more draconian policies.
Now, how's Macquarie's relationship going with the other sort of key player in the colony at this point, the military?
Macquarie really impressed the free settlers and the convicts in the society by being prepared to turn against his own men. He sought the recall of his own regiment, wanted to send them back to Britain, and the introduction of civilian juries, because soldiers judging their own was proving to be a real problem. He didn't get that wish at the time, but it was something that he lobbied for. The courts relied on officers to serve in juries, but they also required lawyers to represent the interests of parties in court. And at the time, there was only one non-criminal lawyer.
And you don't mean specialising in criminal
matters? No, I mean only one lawyer in the colony who had not been a criminal and sent out as a convict. And this was a problem because the two judges, Ellis and Geoffrey Bent, the Bent brothers, decided that they were not going to open their court, and they refused to hear cases where there were ex-convict lawyers appearing. Macquarie had real problems with these two men. Ellis had earlier accused Macquarie of having shown a great want of feeling for my attention and personal comfort by not building a big enough house for him. So every time the governor enters church, Ellis sits down rather than standing up. He refuses Macquarie's directions, saying that the separation of powers means he can do what he wants. But the problems that were had with Ellis magnified when his brother Geoffrey comes to the colony. So Geoffrey is furious that he hasn't been made a knight for coming out to sit on the bench in New South Wales. He insists on a full military salute before he gets off his boat. He says that because he's a judge, he can do what he wants and that he doesn't have to pay tolls on Macquarie's toll roads. And he actually threatens to jail the toll keepers and burn down their toll gates. They keep on asking for money and he keeps on saying no. And finally, Darcy Wentworth, who is the commissioner responsible for tolls, issues a fine for toll evasion. At the end of the day, this period of turmoil comes to an end when Ellis conveniently dies and Macquarie sacks Geoffrey and sends him packing back to Britain.
Didn't have to pay his toll back to Britain, I suspect. So Macquarie's having problems essentially with the remnants of the class system, in much to anything else. Problems with the military and the judiciary. How did the church fit into this?
Samuel Marsden had done a better job than the Reverend Johnson in terms of embedding the church into society in New South Wales. And Marsden starts attacking Macquarie for his emancipist policies. And he also believes that Macquarie's secretary has written satirical pieces against him in the government newspaper.
A lot of satire going on.
Yeah, and there's this great satirical piece that criticises Marsden for opening up the first public lending library in Australia, and Marsden had got subscriptions, vast subscriptions from Britain to set up this library. The library was nowhere near the public. It was actually on Marsden's country retreat.
Uh-huh.
And all of the books in this library had to do with religion and sheep, which were Marsden's two great interests. So Marsden is furious with Macquarie, and he's writing back to Britain, accusing Macquarie of neglecting sick and female convicts. But all of this is leading people in Britain to say, what's this guy doing down there? He's building all of these fopperies and follies, and his emancipist policies were causing concern that New South Wales would no longer be a place of fear and that people would actually commit crimes in order to be sent to such a nice place where at the end of the day, criminals might be promoted to judges and rule the colony. Britain wants to keep New South Wales as a place of terror. And so what do? When they want to make changes but they don't want blood on their hands, they commission an independent inquiry. A guy called John Thomas Big, who was a really big John Thomas, and he was sent out to inquire into how transportation might once again be made an object of real terror.
How charming.
And to inquire into the conduct of leading citizens, including Macquarie. And he was given extraordinary powers to make recommendations that Macquarie had to implement unless he wanted to appeal them directly to the King.
So you've got kind of like a royal commissioner of sorts coming in. And
It's exactly what it was.
Stirring things up. And how did he approach that task?
He spends 2 years in the colony, and he generally starts every interview with, have you any complaint to make against Governor Macquarie, which shows you that he had formed certain preconceptions before his inquiry started.
And look, when would an Australian ever whinge about those in authority?
All the time. And there was a sort of huge queue of critics lining up to put the boot into Macquarie. So Marsden was there, members of the exclusive faction were there. Even poor old Francis Greenway had been encouraged to disassociate himself from Macquarie. So Greenway says, I didn't have any responsibility for all of this stuff going up. I was just the builder and Macquarie was the guy who was telling me to do it.
Now, in all this story, we haven't yet discussed the man who saw off three previous governors, good old John MacArthur, the father of the pastoral industry, who owned half of New South Wales at one point, as we heard in a recent episode. Did he take a crack at Lachlan Macquarie as well?
MacArthur actually plays the greatest role in setting the tone of the three big reports that the Royal Commissioner or Commissioner Big wrote when he got back to England. MacArthur had spent 8 years in England after the Rum Rebellion. He'd become a radical vegetarian, which is a clear sign of mental instability and is really unusual for a sheep farmer. And he suffers from chronic depression. And he really wants to come back to New South Wales. And finally, after 8 years, the British authorities say you can go back if you stay out of political matters. And that was something that he was just unable to do. He's welcomed with open arms by Macquarie.
MacArthur to Macquarie.
Yep. MacArthur professes his loyalty to Macquarie, and all the time he's telling Macquarie his mate, he's testifying before Big.
So what a huge surprise. John MacArthur manages to turn a situation around to suit his own interests.
He does, and this betrayal personally hurt Macquarie, who'd been a supporter of MacArthur's, was great friends with Mrs. MacArthur. And what one of the things that really hurt Macquarie was the charge that he was democratic.
Right.
Now, Macquarie had fought against the French and American republics and had written of his hatred of the infernal and destructive principles of democracy. He was a card-carrying Tory autocrat. Big's report echoes all of MacArthur's concerns about Macquarie and his administration and endorses MacArthur's proposal for a colonial aristocracy of wealthy landowners who would produce wool for Britain.
So this marks the end of Macquarie's time in the colony, does it?
Yeah, look, Macquarie knows the writing is on the wall. He resigns, that resignation is accepted. He sets sail for Britain in 1822 with his wife, his son, and an entire boatload of kangaroos to give to his friends and patrons back in Britain. And so you've got cheering well wishes farewelling him from the docks. He was, when he left, still an incredibly popular governor.
So despite his conflicts with some of those in positions of authority, the ordinary New South Welsh person was a fan.
They were. And Macquarie only has two more years left to live of his life. And he spends those years rebutting the big reports. The British Treasury is demanding that he personally pay for the $10,000 he imported into the colony.
To establish the currency.
Yep. They said you had no authority to do that. Please pay us back 10,000 Spanish dollars. He fights that off, but he's in debt. He is living in a tiny leaking house without even a room of his own now. He spends his time arguing for a pension, and he dies 5 weeks after it was granted, but before a penny was paid. But back in New South Wales, they have a subscription where they build a lovely monument for him and extend their thanks for the job that he did in the colony.
And you have to say that he certainly made sure he was remembered by naming every second thing in New South Wales, Macquarie or Lachlan. A giant of the early days of New South Wales, certainly.
Absolutely.
Lachlan Macquarie, despite the somewhat bittersweet ending. What about his foe, who's now seen off Governor Number 4, the very cunning John MacArthur?
He goes on to establish Australia's largest agricultural company, rather unoriginally named the Australian Agricultural Company. He's appointed to the newly established Legislative Councils, which is one of Australia's first democratic institutions, which advises the governor on policy. But he becomes increasingly paranoid. He starts accusing of his wife, Elizabeth, of having had affairs behind his back while he was away from the colony. And he accuses his children, who he'd always loved and cherished, of conspiring to rob him of his fortune. So he starts wandering the streets of Parramatta in a dishevelled and undressed state. He's waving swords and pistols above his head and shouting incoherently. He's pronounced a lunatic, and he's confined by his family at his country property in Camden, where he couldn't embarrass them. So he dies a couple of years later after being declared a lunatic in 1834.
An ignominious end for the man who was more powerful probably than any governor of New South Wales.
Absolutely.
So there you go. Two of the men who built the foundations of modern Australia. An alcoholic fraudster, David, and a mad vegetarian.
Yep. One dies poor but loved, and the other one dies rich, reviled, and without trousers.
In the next episode of this podcast, we'll look at the mothers of a nation. We'll get to know Mary Reeby, the cross-dressing horse thief made good, and Carolyn Chisholm, the sex worker's friend, who died as an impoverished English as a second language teacher and cake decorator. Don't forget you can subscribe to us on SoundCloud, iTunes, or the podcasting app of your choice. Catch you next time on Rum, Rebels, and Ratbags.